You're listening to the podcast at the biopharmaceutical section of the American Statistical Association.
Statistics.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Big Vic Show. This is Richard Zink, and you are listening to the podcast of the biopharmaceutical section of the American Statistical Association. This is episode 34, and our topic today is patient preferences and medical product evaluation. In this episode, I talk with Telva Irini and Martin Ho to find out more about this increasingly important topic. I also want to take this opportunity to point out that CDRH has issued a final guidance document entitled Patient Preference Information, Voluntary Submission, Review in PMAs, HDE Applications, and De Novo Requests, and Inclusion in Decision Summaries and Device Labeling. When you get a chance, check out this important document. And now, on with the show. Our topic today is how to incorporate patient preferences into medical product evaluation. Today I'm talking with Telva Irini, Deputy Director for the Office of Biostatistics and Epidemiology at the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and Martin Ho, Associate Director of Quantitative Innovations at the Center for Devices and Radiologic Health at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Good afternoon to both of you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How did each of you become interested in statistics? Telva, let's start with you.
Okay, I was born and raised in Brazil and was always very interested in math and science. I ended up majoring in both physics and math at the University of São Paulo, but my strength was really math because it was more intuitive to me. After my undergraduate studies, I was hired by the largest bank in Brazil to work in their decision support department. At the time, inflation in Brazil was rampant, and one of my projects was to provide monthly predictions of inflation so the bank could set interest rates for its products. We used both econometric models and time series analysis to make these predictions, but the time series analysis always gave better predictions and we could check it a month later. So the bank was very interested in the professional development of its employees and encouraged me to pursue a master's degree in statistics at the University of São Paulo. They let me leave work during the day to take classes twice a week and were very supportive. The whole department attended my thesis defense, which was on Bayesian statistics, and we compared the Fisher's exact test with a Bayesian test. After my master's, I decided to come to the United States to continue a doctoral studies in Bayesian statistics, and I came to Berkeley. As soon as I arrived, I met Professors David Blackwell and Richard Barlow, and they immediately advised me to concentrate my studies in the foundations of the Bayesian approach, and also on applications of Bayesian statistics and decision analysis. I ended up obtaining a second master's degree in operations research, and then a PhD in Bayesian statistics with applications to engineering. Once I finished my PhD at Berkeley, I came to the East Coast to work at the School of Engineering at the George Washington University. I stayed there several years and spent all my time advising, teaching, and conducting research in Bayesian statistics and decision analysis. But in 1998, the FDA was interested in using the Bayesian approach in medical device clinical trials because the agency thought that prior information could be useful to power the trials and to decrease the sample size and the time for device approval. At that time, I left the university and joined the FDA for the implementation of the use of Bayesian approach in medical device clinical trials.
Like Telva, my interest in statistics began at another discipline. I was an economics and mathematics major in college, and I took a very lively interesting statistics course by Danbury. He often picked a statistical topic in the news and walked us through his thought process, often with a Bayesian flavor. He convinced me that statistics is best done for decision making. When I was an economics PhD student at Yale, I heard the same theme in econometrics, which often models learning agents by Bayesian statistics. I later switched to biostatistics, and it was fun to witness how statistics was applied in areas beyond economics and finance. For example, I take part in patient-reported outcome measure development for psychologists, and I was also working in a macular reading photo centers for an ophthalmology research group. I then worked for the industry for 10 years. When I joined the FDA Center for Devices and Radiological Health, I was lucky to have Talbot as my supervisor. She introduced me to the intriguing and evolving world of Bayesian clinical trials and the critical insight from the decision analysis that works very naturally with the Bayesian statistics.
Very good. Can you both describe your current roles at the Food and Drug Administration?
Yes, Rich. As you mentioned, I'm currently the Deputy Director at the Office of Biostatistics and Epidemiology at CBER. My office includes a division of biostatistics, a division of epidemiology, and a group called the Analytics and Benefit Risk Assessment Group. At the time we conducted the study on patient preferences that we are talking about now, I was the branch chief of the general and surgical devices branch at the Division of Biostatistics at the Center for Devices.
I'm currently the Associate Director for Quantitative Innovations at the Office of Surveillance and Biometrics, which include divisions of biostatistics, epidemiology, post-market surveillance, and the other offices. And my position at CDRH is to introduce, promote, and incorporate innovative quantitative methods into regulatory decision-making at CDRH. I'm also this year's president of the FDA Statistical Association, and I represent my center in the FDA's Research-Involved Human Subject Committee, the FDA's Institutional Review Board, responsible for protecting study participants in the studies sponsored by the FDA.
Can you briefly mention some of the innovations that the FDA is currently working on, at least as far as your group is involved with?
We currently have two working groups. The first working group focuses on introducing patient preferences elicitation methodologies to the statisticians among the statisticians at CDRH and also at CBER. At the second working group, we have our focus on the patient-reported outcomes, how it's being developed, what we are going to use them, and how we're going to use them, and what particular points that we need to pay attention to when we are receiving the patient-reported outcome measures collected from patient preferences, collected from clinical studies. What we learned was that every good patient-reported outcome measures has a very rich statistical story behind it. It's because in order to validate and make the questions understandable to patients, we need to have a good and robust reliability, validity, and other kinds of measures and criteria. So therefore, I think if we just regard a PRO as just another variable and throw it into the analysis, I think we can do better. So therefore, I think my colleagues will agree with me that it has been a lot of fun for us in those two working groups to get to know, learn new things. And meanwhile, our center has received multiple patient preference study proposals coming in for our input. And we collaborate with the sponsors on those studies. And so far, I think I am very happy to see the enthusiasm that I saw in the sponsors about those studies. So these are the typical activities that we have been happening within the CDRH.
Sounds like we're going to cover half of that today and hopefully in a future when we can talk about patient-reported outcomes. In past podcasts, we've discussed
a little bit about CBER and CDRH and the varying oversights they have when it comes to certain diagnostics or medical devices. Can you briefly describe the differences in the oversight that CBER and CDRH have? Because there does seem to be some overlap.
Center for Devices and Radiological Health regulate more than 5,000 types of diagnostic tests and devices. They range from dental implant, MRI machines, to pacemakers and artificial pancreas. The determination of oversight between CDRH and CBER concerning diagnostics and devices can depend on the technology, and sometimes it is even due to historical reasons, and consequently, it is difficult to explain. Sometimes the treatments are so atypical that it is decided by the Office of Combination Products.
Yes, as Martin said, it's difficult to describe the differences. The Center for Biologics regulates biologics, but not all biologics, because some are regulated by the Center for Drugs. Center for Biologics also regulates some devices. Many of the devices regulated by the Center for Biologics are related to assuring the safety of the nation's blood supply. Some of these devices include blood donor screening tests for infectious agents. They are regulated as biologics and come under what we call biologics license application, or a BLA. Mm-hmm. Now, because of testing for HIV, initially came out of concern of the safety of the blood supply, CBER also regulates the diagnostics for retroviruses, including HIV. But both CBER and CDRH regulate some devices for wound and burn treatments, and the mechanism of action for these devices will determine the center that regulates it. In addition, CBER has oversight of diagnostic tests that are considered biologics and not medical devices. For example, these are tests to determine the cause of an allergic reaction.
Well, thanks very much for the explanation and discussing some of the overlap between the different centers. I think sometimes we tend to think of them being mutually exclusive to one another, and clearly there's cases where there's some overlap. Now, you both have been involved with efforts to incorporate patient preferences and perspectives into the evaluation of medical products. And perhaps a really good past example of this is when Tysabri was pulled from the market for rare instances of progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, or PML. Many patients with multiple sclerosis fought to maintain access to this drug since the benefit provided was worth the potential risks. Can you cite some other instances where patient perspectives have played such a large role in the marketing of drugs or medical devices?
Well, patient perspectives have played an informal and qualitative role to inform regulatory benefit risk determinations for a long time. For example, the FDA has the advisory panel meetings, which are designed to provide the FDA with external expertise to inform decisions of whether or not to approve a medical product. And these advisory panels have been including patient representatives for many years. During these panels, it is customary to have a few patients that report their own experiences with the treatments under review. These experiences may be favorable or unfavorable, but in those cases, patients' perspectives have been anecdotal and not necessarily represent the whole spectrum of patients' experiences. Now, more recently, however, the FDA started to explore scientific ways to incorporate patient preferences into its regulatory decision-making. The idea is that using a large sample from a well-designed study can represent most patients' voices and consequently provide information that's even more valuable for regulatory decision-making.
Then 2015 came as a landmark year for regulators considering valid qualitative patient preference evidence to inform its decision-making. Last year, the Center for Devices and Radiological Health approved two new types of weight loss devices, electrical stimulation systems and gastric balloon systems. These regulatory decisions were informed by the evidence of benefit-risk trade-off preferences among obese patients, thanks to the patient preference survey for weight loss devices. The survey was led by Talba and sponsored by my center to measure obese patients' preferences quantitatively. Since the approval of gastric banding in 2007, we look at existing treatment options with extremely different benefit-risk profiles when reviewing new weight loss devices. On one end, diet and exercise or medications are safe, but they are not so effective. On the opposite end, the gastric bypass surgery and gastric banding are very effective, but also extremely invasive. For a new device type that falls between these two extremes, it was challenging to determine if its benefit-risk profile was favorable. For example, compared to gastric banding, how much safer should the new device be in order to compensate for its less effectiveness? Compared to diet and exercise, how much additional weight loss of the new device would patients expect in exchange for tolerating additional risks associated with the new device? The survey results inform us of how obese patients weighing benefits and risks of these devices when we are making approval decisions.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, you were both organizers of a session last year at the Biopharmaceutical Workshop on Patient Preferences. And some of this work described a pilot study in obese patients and their views on weight loss devices. Can you describe this work for us?
As Martin was telling, this work was on weight loss devices and was sponsored by the Center for Devices and Radiological Health. So what we did at that time is that we conducted what we called a proof of concept study. And the idea was to explore how to elicit and how to incorporate patient preferences into our regulatory decision making. So we chose weight loss devices because, of course, obesity is a high prevalence condition with significant public health impact, and also because the treatments for obesity involve very difficult benefit-risk trade-offs. At the time of the study, there were very few treatments approved for weight loss. There was one drug and one device, the gastric band. However, there were several weight loss devices under FDA review, and they all had a wide range on benefit-risk profiles. There were, for instance, some non-invasive retrievable devices that provided low weight loss and that did not last long, and also pose low risk. We used to call this kind of device high school reunion device, just because it was low risk, low benefit, and the weight loss wouldn't last that long. There were also invasive and permanent devices intended for morbidly obese patients. These devices pose a very high risk. We found at that time that it would be very reasonable that riskier devices should require higher benefits. Devices with less risk could provide less benefit. So our question was, how could we quantify the benefit-risk trade-off? In other words, how could we place weight on benefits and risks so we would be able to compare them? To solve this problem, we collaborated with the Research Triangle Institute Health Solutions, RTI Health Solutions, and designed a survey to elicit what we called preference scores for characteristics of weight loss devices. We call these characteristics device attributes. For example, a weight loss device provides an average weight loss. This is an attribute related to the device effectiveness. The average duration of weight loss and the improvement in comorbidities such as cardiovascular disease or diabetes are also attributes of the weight loss device that are related to the effectiveness of the device. The risk of adverse events, the risk of hospitalization, and also the mortality risk are attributes related to the device safety. the type of surgery for device implantation, and the type of diet required by the device treatment are also attributes of the device. So for our study, we chose 8 device attributes that were based on the profiles of the devices that FDA was reviewing at that time. And we designed a special form of survey called Discrete Choice Experiment and interviewed about 650 obese subjects with BMI or body mass index greater than 30. The survey provided 8 pairs of hypothetical devices to each subject, and for each pair, the subject had to select the preferred device. The study used an econometric model called random parameter logit model and analyzed the responses and estimated the distribution of the preference scores of each of the eight attributes. We also developed what we called a decision aid tool that provides the minimum benefit, in this case was the minimum weight loss, patients will require for a treatment with a given mortality risk. The same decision aid tool also estimates the maximum risk patients will tolerate for a given weight loss. These estimates can be obtained for various levels of risk tolerance. In other words, patients with different risk tolerance levels would get different expected benefits and different expected risks. The tool also estimates the proportion of patients who would choose a device with certain attributes instead of remaining in the status quo. But more important to statisticians that help clinicians design clinical trials is that the tool provides estimates that can inform the clinicians in the determination of what we called minimum clinically significant benefit. To be used in design and analysis of a clinical trial to be reviewed by the FDA. So in other words, using this tool, we could, for a device that's coming in the pipeline and going to be reviewed by the FDA, tell what would be the minimum clinically significant weight loss to be designed, to be used in the design of the clinical trial. In my experience at the FDA, the minimum clinically significant benefit is a quantity that's usually arbitrarily defined, and there is a lot of discussion between sponsors and the FDA on what that value should be. And it sometimes ends up being determined based on the sample size the investigator can afford, rather than what benefit the patients will want to experience in exchange for the risk they will bear from the treatment. So, and finally, this study provided a way to determine the minimum clinically meaningful benefit that should be provided by a treatment based on the risk posed by the treatment and also on the patient's tolerance for that risk and the patient's preference. I believe this is a big step forward in designing clinical trials based on patient preferences. Of course, this method can be adapted for other medical products.
So you mentioned this was the result of a survey, and often in clinical trials we often have samples that are convenient samples of patients that show up to the physician's office. So did this particular survey try to select a population that was representative of the larger population of patients who may be expected to receive these types of devices? So balance with according to gender, race, and other factors that may play an important role?
Yes. We used a panel and tried our best to encompass a representative sample of 650 subjects that were representative of the obese American population. And Martin can talk a little bit about that.
Yes. The sample frame is coming from an internet panel that consists of a representative American households For those who don't have an internet access, they will be provided a netbook and internet connection to take part in these panels. So we have to look at their baseline BMI or body mass index, and they have to be above 30 or 35 with certain comorbidity criteria that typically would be an enrollment inclusion criteria for those subjects. And then we asked those panel members if they would be considering using weight loss devices to lose weight. And if both criteria were satisfied, then they would be invited to take part in this survey. So in other words, even though we currently don't have an accurate snapshot, a cross-sectional snapshot of obese patients' age, gender, and other characteristics, but we are doing a very good job at capturing the cross-sectioned household distribution of the study sample.
Yeah, and at the end of the study, to verify if the study population was representative of the U.S. obese population, we made some comparison of covariates, and we found that the study sample was quite representative, you know, was very good in representing the U.S. obese population.
So you mentioned this trial that we're talking about was sponsored by the CDRH, and this subsequently ignited a project called the Patient-Centered Benefit Risk Project, which is part of the Medical Device Innovation Consortium. How did this group and project come about?
The Medical Device Innovation Consortium, or MDIC, was formed in 2012, and it is the first ever public-private partnership created with the objective of advancing the regulatory science around the development and approval of medical devices. It is a non-profit 501c3 organization that partners with the FDA to improve the medical device technology environment. The MDIC members include public entities such as the FDA, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, National Institutes of Health, and Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute. Industry partners include medical device and diagnostic companies, and on the Patients Fund, we have patient advocacy groups and other interested nonprofits and academic experts as well.
So the MDIC Patient-Centered Benefit Risk Project, that's, you know, within the Medical Device Innovation Consortium, it grew out of a need posed by a CDRH guidance document on making benefit risk determination of pre-market approvals. This guidance came out in 2012. And in this guidance, while the FDA stated that patient tolerance for risk and perspective of benefit was an important consideration when making benefit risk determinations, the guidance itself did not specify how this information could be measured and used to inform approval decisions on medical devices. So to close this gap, the Medical Device Innovation Consortium conducted a study or a project called Patient-Centered Benefit Risk Project. The objective of the project was to establish a credible framework for eliciting patient preferences on the benefits and risks of a proposed medical device and for incorporating patient preference information into pre-market and post-market regulatory decisions. So the Patient-Centered Benefit Risk Project developed a framework report to improve the understanding of FDA and medical device companies of how patient preferences on benefits and risks might be incorporated into the regulatory review of innovative medical devices. The framework describes what patient preference is, when it might be useful in the regulatory process, and how that information might be collected. It also examines other potential uses of patient preference information in the medical device development lifecycle, such as during the time of device ideation, in the clinical trial design, and even in the post-market assessment. The framework also discusses what are the knowledge gaps and the research that could be conducted to improve the use of patient preference in the regulatory process.
I think it's very important to highlight an appendix of the framework report, which is a catalog of methods for eliciting quantitative patient preferences. It is such an important appendix that our study group has been studying it and going through it through a regulatory statistical perspective. As far as I know, the catalog itself is the first publication that identifies and provides an overview of a range of available patient preferences elicitation methods related to medical devices. Therefore, it is a very, very valuable resources for researchers, industry sponsors, and FDA staff when they're considering which patient preference methods to support their development, regulatory, and post-marketing decisions. It introduced 15 different patient preference elicitation methods, ranging from point allocation to discrete choice experiment and best worst scaling. The catalog described, reviews, and provide example of prior use of each of these methods. Finally, it provides suggestions for future research. So therefore, it's an excellent starting point literature for statisticians who are interested to know a bit more about patients' preference elicitation methods.
Very interesting. Now, patient preferences and perspectives are clearly an important part of the benefit-risk equation. Do you feel that many discussions on benefit risk neglect the patient perspective? For example, that the opinions may be obtained from clinicians who represent the patient, but not necessarily from the patients themselves. How do you necessarily get the perspective of the patient, even though they may not necessarily be able to talk about particular endpoints in a meaningful way, and balance that with the clinicians who may understand that a bit more?
Well, Rich, you are right. In the past, stakeholders such as clinicians and FDA reviewers, they did try their best to put themselves in patients' shoes and listen to patients' representatives that participated in advisory panel meetings and try to make sense and draw conclusions from a few comments of anecdotal nature. But that's no longer good. Now, recently, we have advances in patient preference elicitation methods, and we can now describe, collect, and analyze preferences of larger samples of patients systematically. So we feel that by using larger samples, we can better represent the whole patient population. We have modern and sophisticated statistical methods and also estimation methods that allows investigators to capture the distribution of heterogeneous patient preferences. That enables us to understand better the full spectrum of patient preferences. So we, in fact, would like to see more studies of patient preferences, and in addition, it's also important to elicit preferences of other stakeholders, such as physicians and caregivers. They also can provide good information for regulatory decision-making.
So we truly believe that this is an area that statisticians can play a very important role. There is an opportunity for them to contribute for the advance of the science of patient input. Although patient preference elicitation methods and their application is a nascent research area, both the patient preference information guidance by the Center for Device and Radiological Health and a framework report by the Medical Device Innovation Consortium can both facilitate outstanding scientists like the statisticians to participate in the actively evolving science of patient input. For example, biostatisticians and Cedar and Sieber, as I just mentioned, have formed a patient preference working group. We meet briefly to review and discuss preference elicitation methods. In the industry, Yang Ji of Amgen and Wei Li He of Merck have collected an initiative on the benefit risk assessment of medical products within the Society for Clinical Trials Quantitative Sciences in the Pharmaceutical Industry Group, or QSPI.
Now, from the previous study that we were talking about on weight loss, it sounded like that was a telephone survey, probably many of us may have expected or have seen in the past, receiving phone calls. Do you think that some of this information may be collected in the future over the web from web surveys or from different social media?
Yes, there are several ways to collect this information. In that particular situation, we had a panel of people that were previously recruited. They were provided with a notebook and also internet access. So we try to be to have the a representative sample, but we can foresee other kinds of patient input, like focus groups and smaller groups. And Martin can talk a little bit about that. Maybe he has some other ideas.
Yes, I agree with Talbot that the purpose of putting together a catalog of method is because we see a range of use and applications of patient preference elicitations, and different methods has its own resources required, and the amount of information and the level of resolution that the data can provide. So different methods may require different may need different methods to suit the research need. And as for the disparate choice experiment or the best worst scaling that we have just mentioned in a patient preference in the obesity study, it required an internet connection so that they would have a good understanding in terms of the benefits and risks of the devices that they are trying to compare. At the same time, I think as the wearable devices such as Fitbits or iPhones or mobile phones becomes more and more a place for us to conduct our business, that would be another fertile area for us to use as a platform for conducting these kind of information from the patients.
We talked a little bit about how patient perspectives can be considered a personalizing of the care of the devices of what patients want to see. And personalized medicine is often thought of as the right drug and dose for the right patient. However, if medicine is truly personalized, and I know we're trying to get away from the personalized medicine label and more to the precision medicine label, the benefits and risks and perhaps even the outcome itself may differ according to subsets of patients. So an example someone's mentioned to me in the past for trials of analgesics and using the time that a patient was pain-free from migraines as an endpoint, and which may not be practically possible or meaningful to that individual patient since they may not necessarily expect to be pain-free at all. Do you think benefit-risk in particular when incorporating patient preferences is an important, perhaps unrealized component of personalized medicine?
Yes, we both think so. As you probably know, preferences on benefits and risks and preferences on their trade-offs are personal, and of course they vary across patients. They might depend on individual experience and circumstances, and in fact, preferences may even vary for the same patient and he ages and his life circumstances change. There is no average person. So, for instance, one person that has a severe illness might prefer to live longer with a lower quality of life, where someone might trade off some lifetime in exchange for a better quality of life. So this is highly personal, and preferences on benefits and risks are related to personalized medicine, in my opinion.
And as a result of that, it's extremely important for us to communicate to patients to assure that they have a good understanding of the benefits, risk, and uncertainty of the treatments so that they can make the informed decision together with their physicians. In fact, I think shared decision making between patients and their physicians is a very active and important area of research. And again, I would like to invite statisticians to play an important role there. Moreover, it can help match each patient with the right treatment that fulfills most of their preferences.
Well, say a company is interested in incorporating or considering patient preferences for medical devices in a regulatory package. What are the first steps and recommendations for these companies?
First, I would like to encourage the sponsor to allow more patient participation in the clinical trial design. For example, in selecting the study endpoint, the sponsor needs to measure what are important to patients and their regulators needs to consider them. And second, the sponsor would like to consider whether the use of treatment options constitutes a preference-sensitive decision. If the treatment option is superior in both benefits and risk compared to existing options, then the choice of treatment is not preference-sensitive. However, if the treatment is more effective but riskier, then it may be a preference-sensitive decision because not every patient would prefer the treatment over existing options. Some may prefer to tolerate additional risk over existing options in exchange for the additional benefit offered by the treatment, while others may not. Similarly, if the treatment is less effective but safer than existing options, then the decision may also be a preference-sensitive decision. So therefore, we would like to encourage the sponsor to talk to the FDA at an early design stage of their study, so that the study results can inform regulatory decision-making. For example, in the CDLH weight loss device study, FDA reviewers provide critical input to determine the regulatory relevance of the attributes, their levels, benefits, and risks considered in the study. And we will be very interested to provide input at various stages of the study. And of course, the exact timing would greatly depend on the design of the study. As I said before, we have already received and reviewed multiple patient preference studies proposals from various sponsors, and we look forward to collaborating with even more sponsors down the road.
But in general, this isn't something, say, companies should wait on to see if they even have a successful package to submit. This is something they need to consider in for the whole development program to potentially choose endpoints and inform the different study designs. This isn't something that can wait, correct?
Yes.
Well, final open-ended question for one or both of you. What will be the what will provide the biggest impact to medical product development in the next 5 years?
I think the patient participation and the use of PROs and patient preference information to evaluate medical products will increasingly become an important component of clinical trial design and analysis. I also would like to see the regulators and other stakeholders, including patient groups, would be able to distinguish scientifically collected patient preference evidence from anecdotal comments from patients. Consequently, this patient-reported outcomes and patient preference information will both be increasingly used for regulatory decision-making to the benefits of patients, sponsors, and the public health.
And in my opinion, as more patient preference studies are conducted and published, major stakeholders will be more familiar with the strengths and weaknesses of various elicitation methods. More qualitative and quantitative patient perspective data will be submitted and considered as supportive data to inform the FDA in making regulatory decisions more patient-centered. Now it's time to seize the opportunity and get involved in the development of methods for elicitation of patient preferences, such as the one we use in our weight loss devices study. We would like to see more statisticians making contributions to areas such as benefit-risk determinations and also to the science of patient input, which encompasses PROs and patient preference information. And we use the science of patient input to inform our regulatory decision making. It will also be great to see more sessions on these topics at conferences, at the joint statistical meetings, and at the FDA industry workshop. These topics are increasingly being discussed at important conferences such as the ISPOR, which is the Conference for the International Society for Pharmacoeconomics and Outcomes Research. For instance, in this year's ISPOR conference that will take place in Washington, D.C. next week, there will be several sessions on the topic with participants from the FDA and also from PCORI. So we see that the science of patient input will become more developed and more in demand, and I think the statisticians cannot miss this boat.
Very good. Well, thanks to both of you for taking time out of your schedule to talk with me today about this interesting topic and the work you're doing at the FDA.